Hello and welcome to the Africa Today podcast from the BBC at 15:30 GMT on Wednesday the 16th of June. I'm Sophie Ikenye. In the pod today, two Sudanese rebel leaders indicted for war crimes surrender to the International Criminal Court. The first batch of UN peacekeepers begin their first phase of their withdrawal from the Democratic Republic of Congo. And as South Africa marks Youth Day, excitement builds in the countdown to the Bafana Bafana versus Uruguay match.
The nerves are gone, you know, the first game and all, you know. We have the talent, you know, we got to do, you know, we got the support. So there's nothing stopping us from beating them.
Two rebel leaders from Sudan's Darfur region have surrendered to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. The men were secretly indicted last year for war crimes in connection with the deaths of 12 African Union peacekeepers in 2007. Their case is part of a tribunal's push to try those responsible for the conflict that the United Nations estimates has killed 300,000 since 2003. Khartoum says 10,000 people have died. Geraldine Coughlan reports from The Hague.
The two Sudanese rebel leaders will appear in court on Thursday to face questions over the killing of 12 African Union peacekeepers at the Haskanita military base in Darfur in 2007. The two men are suspected of criminal responsibility for murder, intentional attacks on peacekeepers, and pillaging. The attack on Haskanita was allegedly carried out by fighters of the Sudanese Liberation Army Unity under the command of Saleh Mohamed Jerbo Jamous and the splinter forces of the Justice and Equality Movement led by Abdallah Banda Abakir Nurein. The case is a fourth before the ICC involving alleged war crimes in Darfur. Arrest warrants are outstanding for Sudan's president Omar al-Bashir, a former government minister, Ahmed Haroun, and a militia leader, Ali Kusheib. But President Bashir rejects the jurisdiction of the ICC and has refused to hand over his two allies.
Geraldine Coughlan reporting there from The Hague. And that is quite symbolic in Congo. The first UN peacekeepers left the country this morning after a ceremony that took place in Kisangani, the capital of Oriental Province in the northeast. Over 100 Senegalese soldiers went back home. More will leave by the end of this week. The move comes after the UN Security Council agreed last month to start withdrawing troops from Congo as requested by the government there. Our correspondent Toma Fesi attended the ceremony in Kisangani.
Well, it took place at Kisangani Airport this morning. The head of MONUC, Alan Doss, and the force commander, General Babacar Gaye, who, by the way, is Senegalese himself, came to attend. The governor of the province was also there. And in a speech to the Senegalese battalion, Alan Doss praised the soldiers for their commitment since they were deployed in Congo for the UN in 2001. The Senegalese soldiers then handed over their weapons, took their luggages and went on the plane, which is taking them back home in Senegal. I asked Alan Doss what was the significance of this first withdrawal, and here is what he told me.
We're withdrawing these troops from an area where we think security does permit, but it's also the start of a process. We've agreed with the government that we'll now evaluate the situation on the ground and reach, I hope, common agreement as to the next stages and the next steps. We want to increasingly emphasize, and I think that's the reason why we're moving from MONUC to MONUSCO, it's more than a name change, I hope, that, you know, we must increasingly focus now on peace consolidation and stabilization. Security, though, does remain a major concern, which is why I think the council was mindful of the need to do this in a phased fashion, and not to rush it, not to be precipitous, and to do it in common agreement with the government. And that's what the process we've set up now.
So that was the head of the UN mission in Congo, Alan Doss. Thomas, I understand that only 100 soldiers have left today, but the Congolese government had requested that 2,000 troops leave before the end of the month. What's next?
Well, just over 100 Senegalese blue helmets have left this morning indeed, but about 460 will have left in total by the end of this week. It's just that there is only one plane going back and forth from Congo to Senegal to take them home. Now, the Congolese authority had requested that 2,000 troops withdraw by the end of June, but what the UN Security Council agreed last month was that up to 2,000, and that's a very important detail, up to 2,000 would leave these months according to the security situation on the ground.
Thomas Fesi in Kisangani. A Kenyan assistant minister, two members of parliament and a political activist have appeared in court in Nairobi charged with propagating hate speech and incitement to violence. The four were arrested on Tuesday, just 2 days after a rally called by groups opposed to the draft constitution was disrupted by three grenade explosions. Anne Waithera was in court in Nairobi.
The court was full to capacity and its corridors were jammed by relatives, friends and curious onlookers as the four were brought before the Nairobi Chief Magistrate. Assistant Minister Wilfred Machage was charged with four counts of hate speech. Legislators Fred Kapondi and Joshua Kutuni face one count each of making threatening statements intended to stir ethnic hatred, while political activist Christian Miller faces one count of incitement to violence. The assistant minister and two MPs were widely quoted in the press as saying some communities living in Kenya's Rift Valley and Nyanza provinces should prepare to be evicted from their land if the proposed constitution is passed in the August 4th referendum. On her part, the political activist is alleged to have made remarks that would lead to injury of those who support the proposed constitution. They all denied the charges and the prosecution's request to have them detained in custody for 3 days was rejected. Soon after the magistrate announced that they would all be released on bail, their supporters held up red cards, which are symbols of the campaign against the proposed constitution. Court officials had earlier warned their supporters against celebrating after the magistrate's ruling. The politicians are all members of the group dubbed the No Campaign that is against the proposed constitution. The three politicians and the activist were arrested by police yesterday following complaints lodged by Kenya's National Cohesion and Integration Commission. This is the first time an assistant minister or an MP has been arrested for such a crime, and the case has attracted a lot of national attention. It is feared that the statements made by the politicians may ignite violence similar to what was experienced after the disputed 2007 general elections.
The BBC's Anne Waithera reporting from Nairobi. Angola's economy might be back on track after last year's global economic crisis, but the United Nations says it still has a long way to go to improve social conditions for its people, and especially its children. A UNICEF report says while infant mortality has improved since the end of the war, access to water and sanitation has not. The BBC's Louise Redvers reports from the capital, Luanda.
Boa Vista is one of Luanda's most notorious slums. In Portuguese, its name means good view, but there's nothing very pretty to look at here. Piles of rotting rubbish line the muddy streets. An open sewer just in front of me gives off an infernal stench, and there are black flies buzzing about everywhere. Here, children play barefoot in pools of green, stagnant water, while their unemployed parents sit behind makeshift market stalls selling warm beer and bags of rice. Fabrice Butler has worked for aid organisations in Angola for 15 years and is now with Save the Children. He explains some of the challenges.
First of all, the city of Luanda is overcrowded, so you have lots of people who live in difficult conditions. I'm not talking about the centre of the city, but in the Musekes. Basic access to water, electricity, education, health are difficult to get in those areas.
Seeing these conditions, it's no surprise that Angola's child health record is so poor. One in five children don't make it to their fifth birthday, and 40% suffer from chronic malnutrition. This and the fact that 87% of the urban population live in slums like Boa Vista is a hangover from Angola's three-decade civil war, which saw millions pour into the cities from rural areas. Of course, there has been some improvement. In the 8 years since peace came, the government has poured millions of dollars into services and progress is being made. Brandao Cove, head of child survival and development for UNICEF in Angola.
There have been a lot of investments in the health infrastructure in general, hospitals, health centres, reference centres, health posts, So all these investments, we are starting to see very good results.
Malaria deaths, according to UNICEF, have decreased and more children are going to school. But despite these small gains, access to water has gone down from 60 to 42% and only two-thirds of people now have sanitation, compared to three-quarters previously. Birth registration also remains low, just one in three getting their documents before they turn one, and only half of births are attended by skilled practitioners. Every African country has its health challenges, of course, but many feel that Angola, which pumps 2 million barrels of oil a day and is not short of money, should be doing a lot better. However, while Dr. Brandao of UNICEF admits there is a long way to go to improve health rates in Angola, he told the BBC that the government is moving in the right direction.
Yes, there is need for improvement, making the service continuously available to the population, but the government is definitely putting much more money compared to any government in many countries in Africa, not only in the development, but in the social sectors, education and water and sanitation.
Brandao Curve, ending that report by Louise Redvers. Later today, South Africa's Bafana Bafana take to the pitch to do battle with Uruguay in the World Cup finals. The timing couldn't be better. Today, South Africa commemorate Youth Day, a day when people remember the young people who united to fight against unequal education during the apartheid era. The BBC's Peter Ndoro is in Bloemfontein. I asked him how much excitement was in the air.
Sophie, I can sense the anticipation of a big event happening today. I'm at a fan park, which is in one of the surrounding townships of Bloemfontein, Rocklands, which is in Mangaung. And, you know, 4 hours before kickoff, people are starting to come through to the fan park. It can take a capacity of 16,000 people. So we'll see as the day progresses just how full it gets. But I've got a few young fans here who have already braved the cold and have arrived at the stadium. Let's find out who they are.
Hi, my name is Ruth from Bloemander.
Hi, my name is Tawu from Bloemander.
Yeah, what's up? It's Gabriela from Rocklands.
Yeah, it's Maasi from Rocklands also.
You guys, why have you come so early and to brave the cold to be here?
It's kind of like just to prepare yourself, you know, mentally get the feel, you know, just when kickoff comes, yeah, you're ready, you know, because win or lose, you know, we got to support them.
In spite of the coldness, I mean, we're here to feel the vibe. We're here to create it at this stage.
Okay, you could have watched this at home on TV and it would be warmer. Why did you come to the fan park?
We wanted to celebrate it because today is 16 June. So we are here to celebrate Bafana Bafana because we've got to beat Uruguay.
Bafana Bafana is going to win, so we have to be there so that we can celebrate.
Okay, now last week, Bafana Bafana surprised a lot of people in getting that famous draw with Mexico. What are you expecting today?
The nerves are gone, you know, the first game and all, you know. We have the talent, you know, we got to do, you know, we got the support. So there's nothing stopping us from beating them.
Are you not expecting too much?
Nah. Maybe I'll expect a 2-0 from Bafana.
Who's your favourite player?
Simpiwe Tshabalala and Tuko Modise.
Sophie, so you can hear there is some excitement and I think great expectation from the Bafana Bafana team, from the fans here at this fan park.
Now, Peter, as one of the speakers there just mentioned, it's the 16th of June and South Africa marks Youth Day today. Is there significance about this day?
Well, you know, I know in Johannesburg it's a big thing because it all happened in Soweto. But I'm wondering, like you, is it a big thing here in Bloemfontein, in Mangaung? Well, let's talk to our young fans here. Is it a big day for you? Is it one that you remember?
It would be hard not to remember it, you know, because we have the legends we have because of the youth of 1976. So it might have happened in Soweto and all that kind of stuff, but, you know, it affected the whole of South Africa, so we still celebrate it.
Yeah, we're supposed to celebrate Youth Day today. I mean, it's a great day. Bafana is playing, then we're celebrating Youth Day at the same time.
You are the youth. I mean, what does June 16 mean for you?
It means a lot of all things because people, the young people in 1976 died for us, so we are here to celebrate the spirit of them. We are here to win because of the Bafana game today.
Okay, so there you have it, Sophie. An important day. And as they're marking that day, great expectations for the team. They're braving their cold. But I think no matter how low the temperatures get, these fans are pretty excited and getting ready for a big game.
Kabela and others speaking to Peter Ndoro at the Fan Zone in Bloemfontein, South Africa. And that's it for today. Thank you for downloading the Africa Today podcast from the BBC, recorded weekdays at 15:30 GMT. You can also listen to our programs and access more multimedia content on our website at bbcworldservice.com/Africa. I'm Sophie Ikenye. Until next time, goodbye.